You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Healthcare reform was a major issue during the presidential campaign, and now that Barack Obama is in office, it may be on the way. But what kind of reform, and will it lead to better healthcare? Luke Mitchell, senior editor of Harper's Magazine, looks at the downside of automated healthcare in an article in that magazine called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. It's in the February issue, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Luke Mitchell to the show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me on.
You advocate a single-payer national health care insurance system. Why do you think that's the best approach?
Well, we've got a lot of problems, obviously, that we're facing across the boards financially in the United States. And health care is tied to almost all of them. For example, we've seen a lot of trouble in Detroit. The cost of every single car we make is hugely expanded by the cost of paying health care benefits for the employees up there. The financialization of most of our economy includes the insurance business, which is faltering considerably, as we've seen in the last few months. And moreover, there are longer-term trends that are going to cause real challenges for the healthcare system, including demographic trends. Everyone's getting older. The people who are supposed to pay for them, that population is shrinking. And the technological costs of healthcare are going up incredibly. So we've got to do something.
Right. Well, you make a strong case, but isn't it the least likely to be enacted because there are so many people who claim it's socialism?
Well, I won't lie. I think the passage of a single-payer health plan in the next few years is incredibly unlikely. And in fact, that's why I wanted to do my Harper story, is to find out why that is. Because a single-payer plan does address most of the issues we face right now in the healthcare crisis. It would deal with the 50 million uninsured Americans, probably more right now, even as we speak. It would deal with the fact that we spend $2 trillion on healthcare every year in the United States with substandard results. We don't have as good a healthcare as most of the wealthy Western nations. And it would deal with a whole host of structural issues. It's not a rational system. And in fact, it's not a market system right now. We have huge government control of the insurance business. We have huge government control of the medical manufacturing business, of the doctors, of every element of healthcare. What single payer does is rationalize that control. It puts it in the hands of single payer, obviously the government, who would be able to make wiser choices about what to do next.
What's included in the National Health Insurance Bill that John Conyers and others have been putting together?
Well, it's basically it's easiest to think of the Conyers bill as a Medicare for all bill. That is to say, it would simply expand Medicare, which works pretty well.
Well, Medicare is socialized medicine, isn't it?
Well, everything is socialized medicine.
Well, Dwight Eisenhower, I remember, called the first proposals for some kind of universal health care system creeping socialism. European countries were all enacting it, but we didn't.
Yes. This has long been the call of people who don't want some sort of collective action to ensure all of our health. I mean, collective action, another buzzword that sounds like socialism. You can have an ideological debate about socialism versus capitalism, and it's a fascinating debate. In the healthcare system of America, it's also a nonsensical debate. It's all socialized medicine.
Well, doctors were among the opponents. The AMA was strongly opposed to it during the Eisenhower years. Are doctors still opposed?
No. In fact, a majority of doctors a small majority, seem to be more and more in favor of some sort of a nationalized healthcare system. And in fact, and this is one of my favorite polling stats ever, they did a poll of all Americans asking them the question, which form of healthcare system would you prefer? And one of the choices was, quote, socialized medicine. And a plurality, I think something like 48%, said they would prefer socialized medicine by name. Which, I mean, that's not something you hear in Washington. I think the preference for market solutions, so-called, is a Washington thing more than it is a national thing.
So you're saying this is a political matter?
It's absolutely a political matter.
But aren't the insurance companies opposed, the HMOs, some hospitals?
Yes. A lot of people are opposed. And, in fact, I think the easy math is, I mentioned earlier we spend $2 trillion every year on health care. And all of the people who are getting that $2 trillion are opposed to changing the system such that they don't get that $2 trillion. And, by the way, they get a bargain on that. They spend about $150 million lobbying Washington every year to maintain that system, which is a great return on investment.
Has Tom Daschle, the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, expressed an opinion on all of this?
He has. He has a plan for reform. He wrote about it in a book that was pretty good, the title of which I don't remember right now. And basically, his plan, sort of like Obama's plan, sort of like Hillary Clinton's plan, sort of like Max Baucus's plan, all of the Democratic plans have come around a couple of ideas. One of them is that Americans should have insurance, all Americans, eventually, which is a good idea. The second is that that insurance should probably be private insurance. And the third is to make this happen, to be required to buy that private insurance. And the fourth is if you can't afford that private insurance, we'll fund it through the government.
Because universal health care may be seen as too radical a departure from what we currently have. So if we have some kind of private insurance, at least it feels like it's just reforming the system that's already in place.
That's right. And there's a belief that's probably accurate in Washington that most people like their health care, current health care arrangements, which I don't know if that's true or not, actually, because
I've yet to hear somebody who likes it.
I don't like mine, and I have pretty good benefits. Thank you, Harper's Magazine. But they could be much better. I think, of course, the 50 million people who have no insurance don't like their current arrangements. But that's, again, there's a set of beliefs in Washington that may not reflect the beliefs outside of Washington. And one of those is that people love their current health arrangements.
My guess is Luke Mitchell, who's a senior editor at Harper's, his column Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs, is in the new issue of Harper's, the February issue. In his column today, Paul Krugman worries that healthcare reform may have been put on the back burner by the Obama administration because we're about to spend so much on the economic rescue package. And I was wondering whether it could also be a strategic problem for the new administration because a reform proposal could bog down Congress for months when they want to get Congress working on so many other things.
Well, I mean, political tactics are a difficult matter, obviously. But I do think that Obama is going to be able to some degree create his own reality. And if he decides that he can that he needs to sell this package, a health care reform package of some kind, as part of the larger reform that's needed, I think he can do that. What he's up against, again, it's these series of myths and strange beliefs that have accumulated over the years in Washington, D.C., that don't really have any bearing on reality, but nonetheless have a huge bearing on the choices we make.
When did health insurance become tied to employers in this country?
Well, that was the basic story, though it's a little more complex than this, the basic story is that at the time of World War II, there were wage freezes, and employers sought ways to encourage people to come work for them. And one of the ways they could do that legally is to offer them a package of benefits, which is ultimately hugely destructive to a lot of positive things. One is that it's now people have attached their health to employment, which means that they can't move from employer to employer. And two, it's actually hurt the labor movement considerably because they also feel that they are unable to fight fights that they would be able to fight otherwise.
Car companies are hurt as well. In fact, one of the reasons we're seeing so much of the manufacture of cars moving to places like Canada is because they don't have to pay for all those health care packages.
Or for that matter, moving to places like Tennessee. It's something that would be so easy to fix.
Well, but we've tried to fix it, and that's why we have HMOs now.
Well, not all of the experiments are going to be successful, but I think we can actually learn a lot from the HMOs as well. There's a financial question: how are you going to pay for healthcare? And there's a treatment question, that is to say, what is the best way to treat as many people as possible for the most reasonable price as possible? And the financial question is pretty easy. The treatment question is incredibly complex.
Well, how would market-oriented health care reform work?
I almost want to reject the notion of market orientation.
But isn't that what Barack Obama proposed during the campaign?
Well, indeed. And in my Harper's piece, what I kept finding over and over again as I talk to people in the insurance business, as I talk to people in the medical equipment manufacturing business, as I talk to people on the Hill, is that they had a real preference for something they could call a market solution. And what they would call a market solution is they would write a piece of legislation, and that piece of legislation would allow someone to make a lot of money, and that was a market solution. But it wasn't an actual market solution because there was no actual competition. So it was more of an idol of a market solution. It was an image of a market solution.
Well, if we have competition, then we run into the same problems we run into. If we don't have competition, then can we give this to some kind of monopoly company to run it? How is that all that different than the U.S. government just adding this to the Medicare system?
Well, that's why I think a single payer is the rational solution.
But it's unlikely to happen.
That is the crisis of the moment. Basically, we are having a hard time in the United States right now as a result of a lot of irrational beliefs. And the solution to that is to be a rational nation. And I don't think that's going to happen soon.
The big debate is over whether health care should be a commodity or a social service or a right.
That's right. It is a commodity right now, theoretically. That's how it's treated. And as long as it's treated that way, people are going to suffer. People are going to have to make choices. There will be winners and losers.
And you say that we're moving toward two classes as far as health care is concerned: those who are sick and need insurance but can't get it, and those who have health insurance but are healthy and don't use it.
That's a sign of success in the current system. In a market system or in a commodity-based health system, what you want to do is maximize your profits. And the way you maximize profits is by spending as little on treatment as you possibly can, and meanwhile getting as many customers as you possibly can who don't require treatment. This is a sign of success in that system, which is a flawed system.
And when you do require treatment, often the HMOs refuse to cover many procedures or to pay the full bill.
Yeah, they call that medical losses. And medical losses are when they actually do pay for you to be treated. And they have very smart people who wake up every morning and think as hard as they can about how to avoid making those payments. They're good at it.
Well, as a listener points out, and we've been kind of skirting around this, we already have single-payer approaches, both the way veterans' medical system works and Medicare works. And why is it so difficult to convince people in Congress that since we already have a bureaucracy in place, we have a system in place, right, that we could just expand it? These things seem to be working pretty well.
It's a great question. This was the amazing conundrum of my piece. Why is something so obvious, something so clearly able to solve a huge problem, not even on the table? And when I went around for the Harper's piece talking to people about this, there was never a straight answer on it. It was always like that moment in a philosophical debate in the dorm room where you reach an impasse and you're not even speaking the same language. And I think, again, it's these preferences for ideological understandings of the world that don't reflect any kind of reality.
My guest is Luke Mitchell of Harper's Magazine. His article in the February issue is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Luke Mitchell, who's an editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of an article in the February issue called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. Can you explain healthcare rationing?
Well, rationing is a word you hear a lot from people who think single payer is a bad idea. In fact, the usual argument is if we have a single payer system, we'll be required to ration like they do in Canada. But in fact, every system requires rationing. Every single system requires rationing because our ability to treat people will always outpace our ability to pay for treatment of people. And especially now, with the amazing technological advance of just the last couple of decades, which accounts for something like two-thirds of all health care cost increases, it's just going to continue to outpace that.
I'm not sure what rationing even means. It means, I guess, waiting for an appointment. But when I call my doctors at different times, they invariably say, well, the doctor can't see you for another month or so unless it's an emergency.
Rationing means making choices, and that's what doctors do. They always make choices, and that's what we want them to do. They will make a choice between will I give you a PSA, a cancer test, or not, because that test costs some money, which is also, by the way, a profit center, and it may determine whether or not you have cancer. On the other hand, you may take the test and start undergoing a lot of expensive treatment that doesn't really help you. That's a hard choice to make. It's a choice that I would prefer a doctor to make. And under single payer, by the way, it is a choice that a doctor makes. But under every system, someone is going to make those choices. Under our current system, that someone is someone who wants to make a choice not to treat you. So you actually, that's not entirely true. Sometimes they want to make a choice to treat you because that treatment is a profit center. But it's all driven by choices about money, not about your health.
Well, technology, advances in technology was supposed to bring down the cost of medical care, but it seems to have brought it up, hasn't it?
That's a complicated question. What I found when I was reporting the Harper's piece is that a lot of the technology is incredibly expensive because it's new and it solves problems that could not have been solved before. For example, I went to McKesson in San Francisco. They're the 18th largest company in the United States, and they are involved in all kinds of advanced technological treatments. And they described a treatment in the future that would be a sort of a caterpillar robot that could make a small incision in your chest. It would crawl in, repair your heart, and crawl back out. You wouldn't have to crack your ribs open. You wouldn't have to have a human being's hands in your chest cavity. It's a hugely expensive technology, and it would be great to have. But a lot of these other technologies will end up saving a lot of money. These are back-end technologies for tracking your health records. These are technologies for making sure your meds are given to you on time. These are technologies for better pills to treat simple ailments. Most of the time that we're dealing with the healthcare system, it's not a crisis for us, but it does cost a fortune.
Well, we have all sorts of things locked in place that keep the prices up. I was in France a few years ago and realized that some eye drops that I rely on to keep my eye pressure in one of my eyes steady had leaked. So I called my pharmacy and said, "Can you FedEx something to me?" He said, "Well, it would never get there in time. Mm-hmm. Why don't you just go into a French pharmacy and ask for it?" I said, "Well, this is a prescription." He said, "Well, not in France. It probably isn't because there's no need for it to be a prescription. We just it's locked in here."
Right.
So I went into a pharmacy, and sure enough, she just reached into a drawer, came out with this little bottle, and charged me what my pharmacist in the United States said was way below what he had to pay for it wholesale.
Right. Well, and that's a perfect example, by the way, of all the clutter we've gotten that's accumulated around solving our healthcare problems. That is to say, your problem is you needed eye drops. Your problem wasn't you needed to sustain a $2 trillion industry. And solving that problem is pretty simple. You get up there, you get the eye drops, you sell them, and you get out of there. Whereas the U.S. solution was, well, we've got to go through a wholesaler. We've got to have this guy approve a thing. We've got to have the FedEx. Single payer actually would save a lot of money.
There are other concerns, aren't there, with new technological advances? Because although it can lead to better screening for cancer, for example, there are people who are concerned that it also can lead to discrimination.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, we just passed something called the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act in the United States. And it's addressing a problem that doesn't quite exist yet, but will exist significantly 1, 2, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, which is that genetic technology is enabling doctors to identify a lot of problems that you will have down the road because of your genetic history, because of what they can learn from people with a similar history to you genetically. And that allows insurance underwriters to make a much more informed decision about whether or not to bet on your health or how much to bet. And, the House always wins because the House has better information. which is why they had to pass this act, which makes genetic information not something that they can use.
And do the insurance companies like this act?
Strangely enough, for my Harper's piece, I actually sat down with Karen Ignati, who's the head of America's Health Insurance Plans, and we talked about the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act. And she said it was a good idea because basically the insurance companies would work around it.
But they're, right now insurance companies will turn people down because of pre-existing conditions.
That's
if
right.
you have diabetes or if you've had a history of cancer, they may very well not take you on. The only way that you can be sure to continue to have health insurance is to have it now and not have a break.
Right, right. Which is, of course, the other genius of single payer. There is no pre-existing condition in a single payer system because you're in the system as soon as you're conceived, basically. So the system has an interest in your health over the entirety of your life.
Can you tell me who John Hammergren is?
John Hammergren is the CEO of McKesson and the author of a fascinating book called Skin in the Game, which is about his vision of what he and others call an integrated delivery network and what he uniquely is involved in currently manufacturing. And this integrated delivery network is a sort of a central brain that would be connected ultimately. And this is a little bit science fiction sounding. It doesn't quite exist yet. But a central brain that would be connected to everybody involved in a particular healthcare system. And it would take all of the information about you or me, our genetic information, our proteomic information, that is about our protein, our heart rate, whether we woke up in the morning or not, whatever information it could glean, send it to the central computer, process it in very advanced ways. We're very good at processing information and learning, generating new information from extant information, and come up with probably a pretty smart idea about what to do to keep you healthy. It'll be hugely powerful, and in wise hands, maybe a force for good.
But you seem to have a lot of misgivings.
Well, you know, power is power. We do with it what we will. The problem in America today is that people don't seem to be wanting to take that power into their own hands as a democratic body and wield it. They want to give it up to other forces, systemic forces like the market.
Well, how is this any different from what President Obama has talked about, computerizing everyone's health records? Mm.
I think he and almost everyone who thinks about this wants to computerize everyone's health records. How you do it is a very complicated matter. Who owns those records? Where do those records reside? What can you do with that information? On and on and on.
Well, since we talked about all of the criticism of a universal healthcare system because people see it as socialized medicine, notions of bureaucracy are there and all of that, rationing, lowered standards, inefficiency, would an emphasis on technology and automation be a way to counter that criticism?
Well, people seem to like things that sound technological, you know, so-called. That is to say, well, it's not single payer, it's integrated delivery healthcare or something. In terms of coming up with a brand that Americans are willing to accept, that may be useful. On the other hand, most Americans seem to be willing to accept socialized medicine.
My guest is Luke Mitchell. His latest article for Harper's, where he is an editor, is Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs. So let's talk about that subtitle, Why We Won't Get the Healthcare System We Need. That's because despite everything that we've been talking about, you assume that all of the positive arguments are going to be ignored and we are going to either continue in this muddled way or come up with some kind of a Band-Aid approach?
There's a lot of precedent in the United States for making bad decisions about major changes. And it's funny, at Harper's we spend a lot of time thinking about these subheads, especially when they're on the wrap. And there was some consideration given to the idea that it would be why America won't get the healthcare system it deserves. But we decided not to go with deserves because Americans are going to get what they want or what they think they want. And the only way they're going to get something that works better is for them to decide that they're going to have to do what it takes to get it. That is to say, call in to their representatives or senators to write letters, the usual grassroots stuff, because it's not going to happen in Washington. The beliefs in Washington are too well ingrained, even in the farthest left. You know, Barack Obama, for example, has long been a proponent of single payer as the wisest, most rational approach, but he seems to believe that it can't happen.
And he had a much more limited plan than Hillary Clinton did.
It's somewhat more limited. They're fairly parallel. Their big debate was over the mandate, and mandates are debatable.
Did you see Paul Krugman's article today?
It was terrific, yes.
So you would pretty much agree with his arguments for doing something right away. He says it actually would be economically in our best interest, even though so many people complain that this would be very expensive.
Yes, and I think the Krugman's point is that it makes political sense as well as economic sense, and I agree with him. So again and again and again, the question isn't whether or not it makes sense. The question is whether or not we can persuade the people who can make these actual choices that it makes sense. That's the obstacle.
And that's people in Congress.
People in Congress and people in the media as well.
Luke Mitchell is a senior editor at Harper's. His article, Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Healthcare System It Needs, is in the February issue. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Leonard.